right, right. Hello, my name is Candace Moore. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you guys for allowing me to participate. I want to thank the committee, of course, for the invitation. I am not as spiritual when I'm driving as I am now that I'm here. So if any of you were behind me, sorry. you know, I thought I have enough time, and then it looked like it was getting a little close, and they weren't driving like I was going to, you know, what. Anyway, I just felt the unity really needed to prevail, and if we just drove like I wanted them to drive, we would be good. But so in any event, if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are new, my friend Ralph White always says something that I love. He says, this is the best step you will ever take from the cradle to the grave. That is heavy. That is heavy, that Alcoholics Anonymous would be the best step you will ever take from the cradle to the grave. That must mean that whatever is going on here is hardcore, is heavy duty. You know what I mean? From the because I think about the time of being born little and, you know, first loves and all these things, but we're saying Alcoholics Anonymous supersedes all of that. It's true. If you are new, you've been given the keys of the kingdom. There's something I also want to share with you, and I want to share it with you now before we sneak it in on you later, and that is that this is a program of action. It is not a program of whether or not I feel like it. There are a lot of things I don't feel like doing, but at the end of the day, I don't feel like dying drunk. I can assure you that if I were to take a drink, I'm not going to be drinking in Laguna. I'm not going to be in this fabulous red wrap that I got for you. You know what I mean? When I started thinking Laguna, I saw red, you know. And so when I drink, I'm going to be in a place, I don't know, it's going to resemble an alley. You know what I mean? And some things will be going on. I'm going to use the word unsavory. How about that? You know, to keep it in a general way. So it's been a long week. I was at a convention last weekend. My schedule is hectic. I had some medical surprises happen, you know, that took a lot of emotional energy. But, you know, and I'm employed. So that means I had to go to work, and I had to give my boss a full day's work and then leave and come here. So the reality is I'm really tired. I'm super tired, and I'd like to rest, but I don't want to die drunk. And so I was sitting there, and I was pooped. And the minute I stood up and I started looking out across the room, I have friends here. You know, that's the reality of when you stay sober for a period of time, you start developing friends on this path. It's beautiful. Newcomer, I urge you to get into the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the view from the center looks extremely different than it would if you were on the fringe. And it's only rumored. I don't hang out on the fringe. I speak fluent, active sobriety. It's the only language I know. But I hear that when people are on the fringes, one, they're bitter. And so, and I don't do bitter. I don't, you know. I may have a little bite, but I don't do bitter. And so when you're on the fringes, and this is just from observation, you don't understand why you have to drive 20 minutes out of your way to pick up someone you've never met, whom you saw once, and she seemed like she wasn't going to be nice, and so why you got to put her in your car, and you know what I mean? Gas is high. I mean, when you're on the fringes, picking up a stranger and taking them to a meeting, it just won't make sense. When you're on the fringes, checking in with your sponsor on a regular basis and attending meetings on a regular basis, having commitments at those meetings, it's not going to make sense. Why I got to set up the chair? Why I got to make the coffee? Yes, I do expect the coffee to be prepared. Thank you. You know what I mean? But I don't want to make it. And so those things, that's fringe living. When you are in the center, it doesn't matter if you've met her or if you're not. There's an anticipation of, wow, there's a life that's going to be saved today. There's someone that's not going to pick up a drink because she wants to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to help set up the chairs, and I'm going to make sure I greet, because this, any meeting is my house. It's a room in my home. And so what happened for me when I came, you made me welcome. So now that this is my home, I have to take care of it. And I want to help arrange the chairs because when you come in, I want you to know that you are welcome in my home. It's beautiful in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I have to check in with a sponsor on a regular basis is because I get crazy, ornery, and evil if I don't. And so, you know, and not everyone suffers from that. I remember, you know, a few years ago, I had gone through a really horrible, horrific, wretched bottom. And, you know, when I went through it, I decided in the midst of my pain and darkness that I should have a baby because I needed someone to love, and clearly I couldn't mess with any of these crazy broads, and so let me have a baby, and I'm going to love my baby. And my sponsor said no. He said, no baby for you. And he said that. Yeah. He said, you're crazy, and you're violent, and you wouldn't want them to take the baby from you. And I remember when he said that, it was after my then home group Wednesday night, and I just started crying. I started crying because it was true. Because at that stage in my sobriety, I was crazy, and I was violent, and I wanted to drink, and I wanted to die, and I thought the solution would be to bring a child into that insanity. So if I could just have someone to love, everything would be okay. So the reason I have to check in with a sponsor is because when I run it by myself and my committee, it's just not pretty. Again, unsavory is the word that happens to come to mind. So there are just three things I want to share with you. They're super important. The first is my sobriety date. It's the most important date in my life. When I got sober, I had no idea that I was going to have a sobriety date. I didn't want a sobriety date. I was just a little pooped. I needed some rest. But my sobriety date is August 16th, 1995. So 14 continuous years for an alcoholic of my type is an eternity. It's an eternity. It's I can't even comprehend it except that I've lived it and I continue to live it. When I came to you, I was super, super exhausted. I came to you worn out. I just needed to rest. I needed to regroup. I needed to rest. I needed a nap. I needed a sandwich. That's it, you know? And so the condition in which I came to you is I was 96 pounds because when I drink, I enhance my drinking with some other things. Those things tend to keep me up 8-9 days. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's really like existing in a dreamlike state, really. So when I am up 8 or 9 days at a time, I don't eat regularly, but I will do a Snickers bar every 3 or 4 days for energy purposes, you know. And so when I came to you, 96 pounds, I was very svelte, And when I came to you, I didn't have a strand of hair on my head because when I'm enhancing my drinking, the side effect is that you tweak. And so now I was convinced that there was movement up there is what was happening. But I am a problem solver. And so I identified the problem and immediately launched into a course of vigorous action. And, you know, and I hope that everyone is here, stay sober, and that we all, you know, just live this sober life forever. But if you go out, do not take advice from your drunk friend. That's all I want to say. So I'm drinking, I'm doing my thing, my buddy's there, we're doing our thing, and I say, hey, something's in my hair. And so she said, how do you know? And I said, because it just ran from this side to that side. It's not in my head. I know it's happening. And she didn't say that it was a direction for me per se. What she said was, you know, rubbing alcohol will sterilize anything. And so I see the writing on the wall. And so what I did is I got some rubbing alcohol, and the next time I was getting loaded, like a half hour later, I, you know, the movement was going on. They were very aggressive, and so what I did is I sat them down and I talked to them, and I said, look, I'm not trying to evict anyone. It's rough out there. It is. So I said, I'm not trying to kick you out. You can stay. But I am going to sterilize you. I thought it was fair. So what I would do is I would just get loaded, like just, you know what I mean? You're just there, and it's good. And I would pour rubbing alcohol all over my head. It was soothing, really. No, it was. It was like mint. It was like that. That, you know what I mean? It was very refreshing. And so after a while, they became immune to it, much like a roach. I don't have roaches. Let me just put that on the tape right now. I don't have roaches. However, in the past, we have had interaction. And so if you, and I know we don't have roaches in Laguna, but if you have ever had roaches, here's the deal. You'll get Raid. That's the solution, problem solution. So you'll spray the Raid. What they do is they tell their friends, don't go. She has Raid. Don't go, right? But if that roach had the characteristic of an alcoholic, the characteristic of defiance, what will happen is that same roach that once cowered, that was once trembling, days later, you see a little helmet, a little jacket, you know what I mean? Little boots. And so you're spraying and he's swiping. I mean, it's bad. And so I'm not saying there were roaches up there, but whatever it was, they had retaliated and I needed to take far drastic measures. So what I did is I got a pair of scissors and I cut off all my hair. And to be thorough, because that's the key word for this evening, to be thorough, I took a shaver and I shaved all of my hair to the scalp. Yeah. Because I don't want them clinging onto a follicle, you know, and yeah. So it was like, you know, I don't know, I'm going back. It was like Sinead O'Connor, you know what I mean? And I'm going to tell you something. I would wear T-shirts on my head as if they were fashionable turbans, just making my own statement. Now, it was quite the vision, I can assure you. And then there's that one other thing. When I came to you, I was missing my front tooth because I'm a mouthy little alcoholic. And apparently someone begged to differ with something I had to share. So, you know, for me, the beauty of all that is when you saw me, it was clear that whatever was happening wasn't working. And the bonus is that when you look like that, no one's trying to 13-step you. You know? I know we don't 13-step in Laguna, you know what I mean? But, you know, so it's not as sexy, you know. And when I came to you, I was super tired. I mean, I looked tired, but, like, inside, I had been gutted out. I was tired. And all illusions, all delusions, and all facades have been stripped from me. The reason I continue to stay in the center of you is that through application of all 12 steps, and equally as important, all 12 traditions, all illusions, all delusions, and all facades are continually stripped from me. If I am going to stay with you, I have to get right-sized. I suffer from a disease that is ruthless. It is an assailant. It wants to do me grave harm. It wants me alone in a room with a gun in one hand and a drink in the other. But there is no way it will ever take me away from you when I am in love with you. It has to go about setting up a series of circumstances and events that make it look as if my case is different. That make it look as if you don't have my back. That make it look as if I've made too big a deal out of all of this to begin with. So that's why I have to have the second thing in place, and that is a sponsor. My sponsor is Clancy. He is sober a lot longer than I am. He's incredibly active. I am incredibly active. I came to Clancy at 9 years sober. My former sponsor, Gloria Decker, was the love of my life. She gave me everything. Everything, the foundation I stand on, was as a result of her direction, her being willing to tell me the truth. Sometimes we can love people to death here. She told me the truth, whether I liked it or not, and she gave me direction as to how to heal and become the woman I wanted to become. When I came to Clancy, I came to him at 9 years sober, on the heels of that hideous, wretched relationship breakup. And, you know, When my ex and I split, I'm going to tell you something. I just wanted to die. Have you ever been to that place where you just want to die? I wanted to die. I have never been in love before, and there's no way you could have told me that I would be that strung out that I would want to die. I didn't want to breathe another breath. It hurt too much. When we got into the relationship, there were signs, you know, little ones, little flags. And, but I thought we gonna work this out because I'm committed. When I'm committed, everybody's committed, you know. And, so the relationship was verbally and physically abusive. I participated equally in both. It is not the way you've raised me. I was almost 7 years sober when I got into that relationship, and really, she was my everything. Everything. I had no idea that in the area of relationships, I was still so broken. I didn't know until much later, until doing a lot of work to save my sobriety. You know, my sponsor, Gloria, has since passed, and at the time, she was frightened for me because everything about me changed in order to justify staying in this relationship. And what she would say to me, she would say, Candace, you have to get out of this relationship. Candace, you are living drunk. I'm talking sober, but I'm living drunk. And I would say to her, I can't leave because this is my soulmate. And so convinced that she was out of her tree. Now, previously, she had given me sound direction. But in this area, she just seemed to be a little foggy. And so I had to go to God himself. And I did. Skip the middleman. Go to the source. God, give me a sign. Should I stay in the relationship? The police came. Oh, no, not that sign. Right? And so, you know, what do you do when it's just gone down the drain? It's just in the toilet. Well, we did what you think we would do. We got engaged. Duh. And, and we were engaged for 6 days, but they were long days. And at the end of it, it was game over, and it just hurt more than I can tell you, really. It brought me to my knees. And I was in so much pain, and I was so angry with God, I could, just couldn't believe that a God that I'd been praying to would have me so open like this, that I would be this hurt. I was so angry. I was so devastated, I thought I would never recover. Magically, 6 days later, I was in another relationship. Who knew, you know? Sometimes you just have to pick up and move on, you know? And it was verbally and it was physically abusive, and the police were back at my house. And I sponsored a lot of girls. I started losing all the women I sponsored. And at this time, I'm 8 years sober. So understand that a lot of the women I sponsored, I had had them since I was a year sober. I had been in their weddings, thrown them bridal showers, baby showers. We were a family, housewarming parties. We were a unit. And I started losing them because the message I was carrying was not the way I was living. They didn't feel safe with me, and I didn't feel safe with me, but I couldn't get away from me. And it was just hurt upon hurt. I couldn't even distinguish it anymore. So when I was in this other relationship, I am devastated. I'm trying to employ old tools, which is, how do I get over one? I get with the other. What that is an indication of low self-esteem, a woman that doesn't understand her worth. I didn't know that. When I got into the second relationship, she was already in a relationship. But I look at it. when I run it through my committee, what we came up with was this. She had been pursuing me for the last year of my relationship, and I would say, no, I'm not going to cheat because I'm fairly monogamous. And so when my relationship ended, the fact that she was still in one really was an outside issue, you know. And so I went to the meeting. My former partner is not an alcoholic, has never drank or drugged a day in her life, which was an indication we were never going to work. But, you know, the second person that I slept on over to was an Alcoholics Anonymous. And so how we hooked up is I went to the meeting I knew she would be at. I held up my left hand, signaling the absence of my ring finger, basically a come-hither look, and we hooked up. And so we're doing our deal, and we're beating the crap out of each other, and police are back, and it's just a bad deal, and I'm speaking to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's summertime. I'm wearing long sleeves and turtlenecks because I'm bruised. And I gaze adoringly at my partner for a couple of reasons. One, I want to give you the illusion that we are a happy couple. Two, I want you to know, hands off, she's taken. It was a hard way to live. So the night came where I just couldn't take it anymore. I'm done. It's hurting too bad. I don't want to be here. We're in bed and I look over and I just ask, it's like a random question, if I drink, would you leave? It's random to me, you know, anyway. She said no. So then I asked another random question. If I drink, will you drink with me? And she said yes. Because she loved me like I loved my ex. And the reality is that there was no alcohol in the house. And so we got through that night not drinking. And the next morning, when I got a hold of my sponsor who, you know, had a very rare lung disease and was sick and in the hospital all the time, when I got a hold of her and I shared with her what I had done, what she told me is that I didn't have the right to jeopardize another person's recovery. She told me that what I had was a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. It's in the book. And she said, Candace, why don't you stop quoting the book and start living by the principles? And I asked her, how would I make amends to this person? And she said, you get away from her. So I ended that relationship, and almost 3 weeks later, she was drunk. Now, the reality is I don't have the power to get anyone drunk. I don't have the power to get you sober. I don't have the power to get you drunk. But I am clear as to my part in that equation. You know, the reason I love Bill's story is because Bill was just wackadoo. I'm so glad he didn't do crack. You know what I mean? He was already so gone. You read Bill's story, he just gets you sucked in. You know, he says, for 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. You're like, go, Bill, go. And then he says, but then that frightful day came when I drank once more. You're like, no, Bill, no. And then there's that time where his friend is coming over. He and his friend used to get their drunk on. So it's all about singleness of purpose. Bill sits the bottle on the table. We don't need to, how you doing, how you doing? It doesn't matter. Here you go, right? So his friend comes in, but his friend is sober. Ooh, glitch, right? But Bill clearly says, unmindful of his welfare, he thought only of drinking openly with him and recapturing the days of the past. That is me. I am a walking liability when I am in untreated alcoholism, when I am without principle. I don't have your best interests at heart when I'm hurting. Matter of fact, when I run that by my committee, I look at it more like, if I want to drink and you're there, well, how rude of me not to offer you one, you know? And so it's crazy. It's my understanding that people don't just drink because they forget the pain of their last drunk. People also drink because of the conduct of how they live sober begins to outweigh the pain of their last drunk. At 8 years sober, the obsession to drink came back. I had never experienced it. When I got sober, it was lifted. And I would hear people say, I still want to drink. And I was just like, ah, I just felt for them. But I had no firsthand knowledge. At 8 years sober, it was like living in hell. Literally, it felt as if someone were peeling my skin off while I was awake. It was that painful to live with the obsession. And I'm so grateful that my feet have been trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from very strong home groups. I recently left my home group, and now my home group is Thursday night by the book, a Step in Tradition meeting. You know, but I am so grateful that my feet are trained here and I know what to do. It was hard. I remember coming and sitting in meetings and people whispering and saying things about me, and a lot of them were true. I remember having a greeting commitment at one of my meetings, and I would just sob. If you want what we have, you know what I mean? And so even though I wasn't gracious, I wasn't drunk. It's important that you see me when I don't think I can hold on a second longer, just as important as it is when you see me when I'm all gussied up and I'm going to take a cake. I can't just come to you once a year, fabulous. I need to come to you when it's good, when it's bad, when I don't think I can do anything anymore. You know, my grandmother raised me and just loved me. Oh, you talk about being loved. Man, she loved me. Everything in me was okay because she loved me. It was that type of love. And when I was little, I was terrified of the dark. And so at night, I slept next to her, and as she slept, I would watch her breathe. She would inhale, I would inhale. She would exhale, I would exhale, because if she died, I wanted to die with her. That's the depth of love I had for my grandmother. My mom is an alcoholic. She is an alcoholic by her own admission. She was young when she had me. She wasn't done doing what she needed to do. I didn't understand it then. It would piss me off, but I understand it today. My mom is very well endowed. And she believes in packing her pistol in her bosom because she's quirky like that. And so the way she would communicate her needs and wants is she would call my grandmother up on the phone. The way I knew who was on the other line is my grandmother would begin to grip the receiver real tight and that little vein would pop out right in the center of her forehead. And my mom would make some incessant demand to which my grandmother would look at the phone and respond, "What? Absolutely not." Boom, there would go the phone. A short while later, my mom would pop over and just shoot out all of the windows. Now, let us be clear. Let us be clear. I did not want what she had. The disease of alcoholism manifests strongly in my family, but that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic because they drink. I'm an alcoholic because when I drink, I have no idea where I'm going to go, how I'm going to get there, but I do know that I'm going to go. I'm going to get there if a drink is waiting for me. The way the disease manifests in my family is through a lot of violence. A lot of the members favored shooting. I favored stabbing. Tomato, tomato, really. So... It is safe to say that when we all get together at some point, the police are going to be present. You know, I'm going to give you a holiday at my mom's house. My mom is an excellent cook. She's a very big girl. She's an excellent cook. She cooks from scratch. I don't. And, hey, Jerry, there's a seat right here. Come on over, sugar. That's Jerry from Long Beach. Okay, thank you. All right, so anyway. So, my mom is an excellent cook, and when you go over to her house, understand you're going to get a meal because you can't do it like my mom can do it. You know what I mean? She's serious about it. She cooks from scratch. I don't. I don't because I feel that if someone has taken the time to lovingly spell out each and every direction, then why would I go against that? You know what I mean? If it says to measure a quarter of a cup, I will measure precisely a quarter of a cup. If I go even a hair over, I will pour it all out and I will begin again. Yes. That's not how my mom cooks. My mother's like a smidgen of this, a dab of that, a fabulous creation is going to be had. So if she's cooking, I got to go. The way you want to gauge when it's time to take action is by the music that's playing. So you go over, the music is very upbeat. It's good. She would be playing the Spinners, the Four Tops. It's okay. As the day went on, you can smell the aroma wafting throughout the house. And now she's playing Diana Ross and the Supremes. It's good. It's good. As we enter into early dusk, we enter into the Sam Cooke juncture. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Because at the Sam Cooke juncture, you want to get the plate and the foil. You want to lay them side by side. At this point, we become like a sprinter. You want to start getting limber. You want to start getting loose. Because by the time nightfall hits, Billie Holiday, run, run! You know, there has been a metamorphosis that has taken place. By the time we get to Billie Holiday, she has been thinking, she's been drinking, now she's crying, you know, thinking about what's gone wrong. She's only going to be sad for a minute or two, then she's going to get pissed off and want to fight. There you go. So you will get a meal. You may limp out with it, but you'll get a meal. You know, and all of this, when you're in it, it's not a good or bad thing. It's just the way it was at my mom's house at Holiday. You know, got into junior high, my friends were drinking and having a good time. I want to have a good time, too. It's so simple in the beginning. It's not I'm gonna take a drink, hit my bottom, and come to AA. You know what I mean? I just want to hang out. But here's the thing. Here's what happens for me when I take a drink of alcohol. When I take a drink of alcohol, I cease to care about you. Rigorous honesty. I don't care about you before I take a drink of alcohol. Now that I've taken the drink, I'm inclined to share with you that I don't care about you. So please resist the urge to tell me how I have wronged you, how I have imposed myself, because really, you know. And I remember my friends coming to me, tear-stained faces and angst over what I had done the night before, and they would want to tell me each and every word, inflection of the voice, twist of the head, you know, and they would go on and on, then they'd stop, so I'd stop, as if I was engaged. I wasn't, you know, and so when there was silence, I sensed they needed something from me, so I would say, well, that's unfortunate, you know. I don't know what type of nurturing they were seeking, but I can assure you I was uninterested and incapable of providing it. It talks about me in the book. It says I step on the toes of my fellows, and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. Not only am I stepping on your toes, but I am rocking 5 inches. I'm just saying. You know what I mean? So without the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I live in columns 1 and 2. I live in the who you are and what you did to piss me off. It's not until I come to you broken and devastated that I'm even willing to consider columns 3 and 4. What does this affect? How does it affect my self-esteem? How does it affect my personal relations? How does it affect my ambition? How does this affect my security? How does this affect my pocketbook? Column 4, where have I been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened? Because we talk about freedom from bondage. When I went through that bottom and I wanted to drink for almost 2 years. As a result of that, there are a lot of things I don't do now. When you're in a relationship, I would think when people would flirt with me and they were in a relationship, it's because I was so cute. I didn't understand that they were disrespecting me. I didn't understand that they lacked integrity. I didn't understand that they were disrespecting their partner. I didn't understand that they had no respect or value for themselves. But when you suffer from low self-esteem, you will think disrespect is a compliment. You will think that the best you deserve is sloppy seconds. So what had to happen for me is I looked at what happy, joyous, and free really meant. What does happiness, not just throwing it out in the meetings, I hear just the craziest things. Some of us have to die in order for others of us to live. That's crazy. It doesn't say that in my book. It doesn't say that. No. What it says in the doctor's opinion is that the general opinion is that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. That it does say. And that's because we're defiant. So the reason that some of us will die is because we don't want to do what everyone else is doing. And those of us that are doing it will live. It's that simple. So when we talk about happy, joyous, and free, I need to look at what is happiness. What does it look like for Candace? What is joy? What brings me joy? I'll tell you what I discovered. Cartoons. Love them. I just bought Alvin and the Chipmunks the Squeakquel. One is still better because I own them both. You know what I mean? And, I mean, I have them all. Over the Hedge, the Bee Movie. You know, I love them. And what I do on a Saturday morning is I get my Cocoa Puffs and I get my bed with my cartoons and my cats and we eat cereal. I eat cereal. They hate because they want the milk. You know what I mean? But I eat cereal. They have tuna. Sometimes they get a little tuna. You know what I mean? And we watch cartoons. That brings me joy. And what is freedom? In order for me to understand freedom, I had to get clear what was keeping me in bondage. the process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding that which is keeping me in bondage. In order for me to stay here, I have had to go deeper. I can't just go through the steps once and that's it. Every time I take one of my girls through the steps, I'm going through the process. I've done major inventories with my sponsors over the years. I have to, because different things, there are awakenings. My spirit is awakened. And I want to be free, and I want to be happy. And I should be able to be happy. You know, when I think about it, I think about Alcoholics Anonymous. We have, like, hardcore drinkers here. You know what I mean? Like, if you're new and you're thinking, I don't know if it's going to work, you should look around. Like, if you start talking to people and they tell you what they used to be like, you're like, ooh, you need to stay here. Yeah. You know what I mean? So you think about all of us coming together, like, that's power. That's hardcore, from the cradle to the grave. So I'm doing my thing, you know, and so what ends up happening is I end up working for this record label. They hired me as a receptionist. I like to think of myself more of a visionary. Some say delusional. I say visionary. Because really, what I felt is that they were grooming me for CEO. Do you know what I mean? And so any day, I expected them to tap me on my shoulder and elevate me to my true calling. You know? What ended up happening... You leave in 5 minutes before the miracle. Yeah. I'm going to call you a sponsor. Go on. No, get. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Love you. So, call me. So anyway. So I end up getting promoted, and the more I got promoted, the more I got loaded. I worked in promotions for a long time and was a part of a lot of successful deals and multi-platinum CDs and all that type of stuff. It was albums at that time. Woo. And, you know, and so the thing is, look at her partner. Look, just anarchy. Hey, Pam. She's like, I am not going to speak to you. This is not happening. So anyway, So I'm doing my deal, and if you would have encountered me during that period of my life, you would have thought I was absolutely the most self-assured, confident individual you would ever come across. But basically, I felt like a little kid playing dress-up. Every day, I felt as if you were going to find out that my mother was an abusive parent who lived in South Central, and you were going to look at me and say, you are not one of us, you don't belong here, get out. That is alcoholism. Alcoholism centers in fear, lack, limitation, you're not going to make the grade, you're not going to be good enough, the rug is going to be pulled out from underneath you any moment. I'm so grateful to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that have taught me to take contrary action. This is not about if I feel like it. This is about training my feet to save my life. What happens is my grandmother who raised me died. And by the time I found out, she had already been buried. Because the way I lived was so out of control, so wild, that I didn't have contact with my mom. She communicated with me through a P.O. box. And I rarely checked the P.O. box because I was too grand. So the grandmother that sacrificed everything for me, I couldn't even show her the respect of showing up for her in her passing. At the time, I didn't even know it had affected me. I just knew that there was a click. And I remember as the weeks passed, I started looking at my stuff and my stuff was no longer enough. At that time in my life, my stuff was all defining. It was so vital, the position I held, where I lived, who I knew. My friendships weren't based on shared goal and common ambition. They were based on, you're cute, I'm cute, we need to hang out. That's it. No depth and weight needed, don't even bring it up. I came from a world of smoke and mirrors. Talk so fast, dazzle them. They don't see what's really going on. It's not until I came to you broken and devastated that I learned it's an inside job. My dear friend Lynette always says, if you don't go within, you will go without. And I have experienced this. So what ends up happening is I'm looking around. My stuff is not enough. My disease is talking to me. And it tells me that I was living in a world of make-believe and that I needed to get real. But I don't know how to get real. I do, however, know how to get loaded. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about why we drink. And it says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That the sensation is so elusive, although they admit it injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. The reason I remember it is because it resonates in my spirit. Every time I took a drink, it was so superb. So magnificent. Oh, sexy. You know what I mean? I was at Costco. It's like a few months ago. I was at Costco. I'm so digressing, but whatever. I was at Costco, and you know, I was in back. I had, like, whatever I had, and this guy was in front of me, and I was, you know, I was Facebooking, and I'm not saying that this guy was an alcoholic. You know, you just size someone's character up by what they're buying. You know what I mean? And so I'm not saying he's an alcoholic. I'm saying that he had 18 bottles of booze and a loaf of bread. That's all I'm saying. And so, you know, so anyway, I just kind of glance at one of the bottles on the conveyor belt, you know. And I don't even know that there was a connection made. But what I found is that pull, you know, and I remember looking at the liquid, the gentle swish of the liquid. And I started getting a little tingly. And then I looked at the curve of the neck on the bottle, and I thought, that is sexy, right? I found myself getting aroused. Now, here's the thing. You know, I don't think normal people go through that. But it was sexy, because alcohol was sexy. Everything about it was sexy. So, anywho, you know, so I am, it says that I don't know what's real from what's not. When I'm drinking, it's everything. I don't know what's real from what's not because I'm making decisions based on self. I can't differentiate. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Something that may have been unacceptable, inconceivable, just a week or so ago is now par for the course. It's now all in a day's drink. It's a seductive disease. At this period in my development, almost 15 years sober, a drink is not going to come in the form of, here, would you like a drink? I'm clear on that. So what I have to do is I have to know what represents alcohol for me right now by the behaviors. Relationships represented a drink for a long time because of the way I approach them. Deceptive, cunning, sometimes a bully, you know what I mean? I want her, I'll take her. You know what I mean? I mean, just like craziness. These things make me thirsty. When I came through that period and I started getting into a healing process, I went to Clancy. Clancy cared more about my life than my feelings. He gave me direction that, you know, when you want to drink and you want to die and someone is a voice of reason, it seems like they're hollering at you. But he was really calm. But under his guidance and direction, I regained my integrity as a woman. I wanted to be treated like a lady, but I insisted on acting like a broad. The only thing more sad than a drunk, desperate woman is a sober, desperate woman. A woman who, because she has not yet learned her worth and her value, is always clinging to someone. She can never not be single. It's like, oh my God, I love you. It's over. Okay, I can't ever be with anyone. Hey! You know what I mean? When I went through that period, I remember, you know, I started going through the work again, and it got to the place when I started getting into the inventory. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. It was obvious at 9 years sober that I was powerless. I had no idea. I didn't want to hit you, but I was hitting you. I didn't want to sleep with these women. I didn't even like them. But yet, they're in my bed. They were strangers, and some of them I had known for years. But spiritually, you are a stranger. We have no connection. Step two came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Step two is beautiful. Step one has to hurt. It has to feel like you're being gutted out. But the beauty, the grace, the glory, and the warmth of step two is everything. I have to acknowledge I'm not the Alpha and the Omega, and I have to tap into that power. I started one more time writing, what do I need in a relationship with the God of my understanding? I can tell you what I want in a woman. I can tell you how she needs to look. I can tell you what she needs to do, but you talk to me about my God, it's vague. That's crazy. That means my priorities are out of alignment. Because a relationship cannot sustain me. I don't want to date a woman because she doesn't know how to be by herself. I don't like desperate daters. I want to date a woman who understands that she's already enough and that what we have would only complement what's already there. There's a world of difference. Step three, I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of that God. What does that mean? It means I take certain actions because I'm going to launch into step four. It says I'm reborn in step three. The only way I can be reborn is to get into step four and do a resentment, fear, and sex inventory. If I have not done all three, I have not taken step four. Looking at my sexual conduct, my inappropriateness, the harm I've caused, the jealousy I've aroused. That's crazy. But then the hope in the sex inventory is, what could I have done differently? I get to do it differently. What is my ideal relationship? I started listing it, and then I had to meet it. I had to meet my own expectations. I've never had to do that before. Not that I wasn't supposed to. I just didn't think I needed to. I was a 97.3 type of gal. You give me 97%, I may give you 3. And then I wondered why the relationships weren't working out. I had to challenge myself to really stick to what I desired in a partner. And it took 2 years for me to be able to meet everything on my own list. I did not date until I was able to meet everything on my own list. I didn't understand that the reason I kept sleeping with women right off the bat was because I didn't feel I was worth waiting for. That came out of my fear inventory. I thought because I'd done all that stuff on the streets, I just wasn't worthy of asking you to wait. This is 9 years sober. You couldn't have told me I felt like that. I've been through the steps, I do this in AA and I do that and I sponsor, and I'm still broken? I had to heal that. Because if I turn my will and my life over in step three and I have all these fears in four, where is God in this equation? I had to bring my God into it and get clear that I am enough. If I say nothing to you that is of value, understand this. Right here, right now, you are enough. Period. You don't have to wait till you get this, wait till you do that. Right here, right now, you are enough. But now you are charged with acting like you are enough. Because if you don't respect you, don't think I'm going to. And I had to learn that. I shared everything in five and in six. I looked at those defects. Six is painful. You know, I hear people say, oh, if you're angry, you must not be working a program. Whose book are you reading? If I'm angry, it's because you're pissing me off. Anger is a basic human emotion. When it gets into the defect is when I start attacking you when I'm angry. When I lay my hands on you, now it's a defect of character. Lust is fine, a little lust. You know, keep things spicy. But when I lust to the point where I want to destroy your relationship, that's a defect of character. These things will make me thirsty. I started looking at this in six. It was painful. So I went right into seven, and I got on my knees, and I asked the God that I had started developing a relationship with to help me remove what is blocking me from living to my highest good. Made a list in eight and stepped into my shoes as a woman in nine. I looked people in the eye. I made direct demands. I asked if I left anything out, and I asked how I could make it right, not this is what I'm going to do. How can I make this right? Because I don't ever want to live this way again. And what I did was not okay at all. Let me know and I'll do it. And in 10, I check it on a daily basis. Not just what I've done wrong, but what I've done right. The healing process. And in 11, I learned to sit still. I learned that coloring helps me meditate. So I have coloring books. 5 of them. You know what I mean? And in 12, I do this deal. Because having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, the implication is that I was supposed to be taking the preceding 11. I get to live in freedom. You know, I ended up working the streets. I resigned from that industry. I ran out of money. I got pregnant. I was going to abort the baby because I didn't think I could be a safe parent because I don't do background checks of the people I hang out with. And I didn't want to risk that my child's safety. Because there are some people that are fond of little kids. And I don't want to be so drunk that I couldn't protect my child. when I made the decision to terminate that pregnancy, I learned via every news station, every TV station, every radio station that a member of my family had been arrested for torturing, murdering, and dismembering my 8-year-old cousin. And the person responsible is my mom. And it was hard to deal with. Because at this time, the position's gone. I am on the streets. And I'm doing what you do on the streets. This is on every news station. I just remember thinking, I'm going to live like this forever. I didn't think any dignity would ever be in my life. And I went through that pregnancy as if I weren't pregnant. I gave birth to my daughter, Serenity, after 17 hours of labor. And I held her, and she was beautiful. And everything broke in me because I knew I wasn't done. And she would tremble because she was detoxing. That is step one, when you want to be done and you're not. When you want to be done with the relationship, when they cheat on you 58 times and you just think, this time is going to be different. If I hang in there. That's step one. Not being able to tap into a power because I'm just so frightened. I left her at 3 days old. She is now 16 years old. She just turned 16, and I have not seen her since she was 3 days old. The beauty of this is that in 2 years, she may come looking for me. And I pray that she does, because what she will find is a woman of value, of character, of dignity, of integrity, of self-respect. I got that from you. I got that from the women who took time to heal, to show me how to do this deal. We heal here. When I work with a woman, she heals and she breaks the cycle of insanity. And then she works with another woman and she heals and she breaks the cycle of insanity. It's phenomenal. It's powerful. From the cradle to the grave. I made amends to my mom at 5.5 years sober, and, you know, she's very sick, clearly. I didn't think I would ever do it, but the more I love you, I couldn't harbor hate for her. I've never discussed the trial. I've never discussed what she's done, because there's nothing she can say that is satisfactory. There are times when I can't open her letters because it hurts too much. And what I do is I don't open them. I throw them away, and I just write her a letter. I send her a pretty card. This is not easy. You don't get everything back just because you get sober. I have to practice these principles whether someone else is or not. I don't date women that are already dating someone else. I don't have casual sex because I'm worth more than that. And there is a waiting period if I decide that we're going to be intimate, because I'm worth waiting for. That's what happens here. We heal. You know, I think I'm done. So I just want to say, if you want, you know, I was thinking, no, I'm done. Okay, so I just want to say, if you want what we have, you're going to have to do what we do. Thank you.